This is the Page Publishing Book Club. How you doing? I'm Alice Stockton Rossini. Guilt is a very powerful emotion, one that Ron O. could not shake for 50 years. As a young man, his temper got the best of him, and in more than one instance, he hit a woman. A psychiatrist friend told him he should write it down, and while it took a couple of decades, he tells his story in his book, Agony of the Abuser.
Some people I know who have confessed to me that they are feeling the same way. I've had women talk to me and tell me that they've always wondered what it was like on the other side. And I've had women tell me that from reading your book, I realized that I was just enticing my husband to hit me. You know, things of that nature. After I had started writing the book a few years back and I just stopped. And then I just got to the point where I need to know if this will relieve some of my pain and suffering that I feel. When I was 20 years old, I had a girlfriend. I was engaged to get married, and I was had gone into the Army. And when I came home, I found her with somebody else, and I really beat her up bad. And I went back to my post, and I sat there for months wondering when the police was going to come and get me. They never did. I never forgot that. And then I got another girlfriend. We were supposed to move back to Delaware, actually. And when she had the furniture transferred to someplace else rather than back to Delaware, then I got into it with her, and I beat her up real bad, too. And that's when I went to jail for 4 months. And then I got married to my current wife. It'll be 51 years next month. And it was the same. You know, I was drinking all the time. I never used any drugs, but I could not stop drinking. And I was always short-tempered when I was drinking. And I hit her, too. And even after we got married, even before we got married, I hit her, and she married me anyway. But one day, I decided that I was going to leave her and my son. She had a son. And he said, now he was 8 years old, he said, I talked to him and said, don't leave us, we'll do better. So that got me to thinking about what I had done. And I haven't hit a woman since over 50 years, but I just can't shake it.
Did you end up getting any help?
I had a friend that was a shrink, and I talked to him informally from time to time. But I think what really settled me down, I've always been put in positions where I was charged with helping people. For instance, I worked for a creamery here for 30 years. And on that job, they had select employees who, any of their 500 employees, if they were having a problem, they go to those 11 employees and they tell them about their problems. And I was one of those people. And I could always help them, but I could never stop thinking about I had done it.
Do you write about how your marriage did not break up? Your wife stayed with you after you hit her? I mean, how did you guys get through that?
I did not love myself. I did not want anybody else to love me. I wanted everybody to be the way I wanted them to be. And my wife was telling me, but you're athletic. You want to go bowling, go bowling. You want to go play basketball, go play basketball. I just want to sit here and clean the house and play my music. And it bothered me. You need to go with me. And I was very selfish and angry. I was very angry when people would not understand what I was trying to tell them. I think it's that I didn't know how to accept somebody else's love for me. All I needed to do was to figure that out. And once I did, I started to change. I couldn't really talk to anybody about it until a couple of years ago. I was at one of my church guys, and I were out, and I was overwhelmed that day for some reason, and I talked to him about it. So that was the first person I actually sat down and talked to and told him exactly what I did. I never told my psychiatrist friend that I really beat my wife up. I used to tell him that I pushed her or something like that. My friend's also name is Ron. And when I sat down and talked to him, I started to feel a little bit better. But as I said, since I've written a book, I've had several people who come and tell me, that's the way I am too. You know, what do I do? I went to a new dentist, and I was telling him about the book. he closed the door and he says, I'm having the same thing. My wife and I can't stop hitting each other. And it's just something that sticks with you. I think because what I've written has brought comments from other people, I'm able to talk about a little more. It still gets to me sometimes, but I'm still able to talk about it a little more.
So it helped you to write it. It helped you to write it down.
It really did. It really did.
All right, Ron, thank you so much. Ever had to get a mortgage? Then you know what an excruciatingly stressful experience that can be, one that can leave you asking why. What are they trying to do to me? Jim Siebert was in the mortgage industry for 20 years and then got out determined he could help others with his book, Enter the Mortgage Dragon, True Facts from a Mortgage Industry Insider with a Personal Tell-All.
But no one has really spoken about, you know, the behind the scenes with the mortgage industry. Like, for example, how much do lenders actually make on a loan? Because after the mortgage crisis of 08 and 09, people were very quick to blame just the mortgage industry for the meltdown, when in fact it really wasn't, just, you know, to the defense of many lenders out there that were back there during that time. You know, it wasn't just lenders. It was the greed of the consumer also trying to live up to the Joneses and try to buy more house than they can afford. And if you didn't get it as a loan for them, they would go down the street and get it somewhere. So dishwashers that make $12, $14 an hour were buying $400,000 homes when they didn't need to. Oh, but I've got a side job, so I make extra money. Wire loans are what we call them. So no one was ever blaming the consumer. But on the lending side of it, what consumers don't know is today how much lenders actually make on a loan, which if more consumers knew, it would give them a little more ground to negotiate terms on their behalf. One of my sections in my book goes over very detailed, line by line by line, what is negotiable and what's not negotiable. When a client says, yeah, you know what, I'm going to go somewhere else because I can get a better deal, you know, by $2,000 or $3,000, it's amazing how much lenders will throw it at you to go, okay, we can discount now and we can get you into this. I got to go to my, kind of like a used car salesman. Oh, I got to go to my manager. I got to see if I can do this, when in reality, they don't ever want to lose a loan, because these package loans get sold in the secondary market for, you know, for thousands because of what they service over the years. So just in this book alone, I've helped probably about 10 or 15 people that have written me saying, dude, I saved, you know, $2,500. I saved $4,000. One guy said he saved $7,000 on his closing costs just by reading my book. So it's on both sides of the spectrum. It gives the consumers an insight to how the lending world works, which lenders don't want you to know. I mean, quite honestly, there's a lot of information in my book that lenders just don't want you to know.
Like what?
Like how much money is made on the back end on a loan. On a conventional loan, the average is about 3%, not including the closing costs they charge you, the consumer. You know, they charge you a processing fee, a doc fee, which is typically, you know, $1,600 to $1,700, but they typically make about 3% on the back end just by selling that loan off to the secondary market. Then on a government loan, it's typically 4% to 4.5%. Figure, you know, a $500,000 loan, it's $20,000 profit just to sell that loan off. And, you know, that's a plus what they're charging you, the consumer, you know, up front. Then all the interest, of course, that's made on that loan over the years to come. So, you know, $500,000 loan, the average consumer is in each loan anywhere from 4 to 6 years. That's the average. So you figure 4 to 6 years, you know, there's, you know, probably $80,000 to $100,000 in profit that's made on one loan.
How much does the sales guy make?
Loan officers. You know, 2006, 2007, we were making gobs of money. But now typically it's between 1.5 3 to 1.6. In the decimal world, it's 1 and 3/8 to 1 and 5/8. So on average, 1.25% to 1.5%. And then there's typically some quarterly bonuses. There can be other bonuses that are thrown in. You figure on a $500,000 loan, you're making, $7,500, $8,000 on a $500,000 loan. And if you do four or five a month, not to mention all the other perks that come with the job.
Okay. So name the worst lender you've ever had to deal with.
Wells Fargo, in my experience, they were one of the worst to deal with. They really were. But they're bottom feeders. They hire people off the street. Hey, do you have an MLS license? Great. Sign here. You're on board. Here's a phone. Take a call. Go get a loan. And that's pretty much it. But they pay them pennies, literally pennies, whereas Wells Fargo profits all the rest of that money. So, there's huge profit margins for Wells Fargo, but they hire idiots to originate loans. And probably even bigger idiots to underwrite them.
All right, Jim. Very timely, this book. Thank you. John Banas is a project manager for an information technology company in Chicago. How he finds time to write, I have no idea. But when he was 8 years old, he read Andromeda Strain, and he was determined he would write a book one day. Decades later, Hurricane Katrina gave him an idea for a murder thriller. It's entitled Storm Surge.
Well, the book is about Brenda Myers and her increasingly estranged husband, Don. They haven't been getting along very well. Don's going through some bad times at work. And a former fiancé of Brenda's, who still pines for her after 20 years, has just informed her that he thinks that his wife and her husband are having an affair.
Oh.
To top it all off, Ashley Myers, their daughter, is trapped in Katrina-targeted New Orleans right before the hurricane strikes. And the story is about a rescue mission and how these three individuals kind of come together to pursue their own means. I mean, a lot can happen to a well-insured, estranged husband in a disaster area, right?
Right.
And so when Brenda knows that her former fiance is connected to nefarious characters, and that she fears that that there's a contract out on her husband, now she's got to find her daughter, rescue her daughter, and actually try to stop a professional hit without painting a target on her own back.
Nice. Very nice.
I follow the James Patterson methodology of having short chapters and plenty of them with a cliffhanger at the end of each chapter. The book does resolve. It will be a standalone, unlike other stories I am working on that may have some serialization potential.
Okay, so now you're on a roll. Is that it?
Yeah, absolutely.
While you're on the road, you have like copies of your book in the trunk somewhere?
No, I'm promoting it through social media. I'm also promoting it through various podcasts like This Week in America and radio stations such as yours.
Okay, so how was this experience for you, developing the plot, writing it?
Well, I'll tell you, it was far more complex than I ever thought it would be or ever thought it should be. The thing that helped me is I plan for a living as a project manager. And so I could plot out and plan out using the same tools as I do in the information technology world, kind of what happens to my characters and where they're going to end up and what's going to happen to them. Using other tools like the internet, you kind of put everything together and pretty soon you have a synopsis, which turns into a first draft and it turns into a book.
How were you with dialogue? Did that come easy for you?
Dialogue is very important to me. I don't do a lot of speaking in dialect like Mark Twain does. I think that gets really cumbersome at times, but I do sporadically throw out a lot of the Cajun phrases and words just to give the reader a flavor of where they are. Dialogue is very easy for me because I used to be a bill collector on the phone and listening to people. I hated that job, but you know what? It taught me how to listen to people, how to pay attention to cadence, intonations, and that certainly was instrumental in me being able to put different types of dialogue and different types of dialect into the story. Page has been awesome. I mean, they've been instrumental in forming this thing. When they handed me my book in hard copy form, I thought, wow, this is a real book. This is really happening. I mean, it's no longer a hobby. This might be a true vocation for me. And that's what I'm hoping for.
That's what you're hoping for? You're going to give up that project manager job?
In a New York minute. Kind of like the idea of working from home all the time and messing up other people's lives instead of my clients' lives.
All right, John, get in line. That's all I could say. Benjamin Sanford recently retired from the Air Marshals and settled in Maryland, where he finally found the time to explore an idea he developed while flying a few years back for a fantasy. It's entitled Freeborn.
People can wield magic, so those whoever has it uses it to gain power. So, and it's passed on genetically. And the whole point of the story is having somebody, like, you can't really stand to authority unless you have power yourself. And so that's what the idea of Freeborn is the main hero in this is immune to its power. So he has the power to stand up to it. He also has other abilities to help them stand on his own. The main character is a character named Ethanos Blagan. Ethan is his nickname. He's the son of a lightning lord. So basically in this world, I always try to envision if there's a world where magic was used, that if people would have it, would gain power and hold on to it. So like they would become the monarchs and the kings. So the kings would have most of the power, nobles would have a little bit, and the peasants would have none. And in a world like that, you can never, absolute power is corrupting. So of course people would be pushed around and abused. So the main character is the first person born throughout the history of this world where he's immune to magic. But he's also can regenerate. So if you cut him or stab him or whatever, he can regenerate. He can heal himself. He's also got incredible strength. So he wants nothing to do with the feudal society he's in. So that's why it's called Freeborn. But there's a dueling destiny for him between his great-grand-grandfather believed he was a prophetic figure called the Freeborn who would bring freedom to this world. And he wants nothing to care about. He doesn't want destiny either because that confines him. And there's also another dual prophecy talking about he would actually be just the opposite. He would enslave the world forever. And that's where the story goes. This is the beginning of a trilogy. And from where it begins to where it ends, he has to come to terms with these two dueling forces pushing him in opposite directions. It's funny because the first chapter I wrote was actually maybe the 10th chapter where I actually had Ethan coming back to his homeland and had to help his father because they're under attack by these other kingdoms. And that was the first one. And by that point in the story, he's already transformed into his own personality and character has already been transformed to who he truly is. And that's where I started the book off when I started writing it. And then I wrote the end of it, and then I wrote everything else followed thereafter. But I sort of, at the end of the first book, I still leave everybody a little bit hanging because their real point of it doesn't get solved until you understand what the Freeborn actually means and what it does is at the end of the third book. You understand exactly what his purpose is. To me, my favorite stories when I was growing up, and whether it's in books I've read or films or shows that I like, is first of all escapism. I wanted something, a story you enjoy, or a story where you always want to picture yourself as the character, and what would you do, or a power to have the power of have a character who has the power to transform their world, and how you would like to see it be. I look at the way things are nowadays, like people don't really appreciate the freedoms we actually have now. Where if you go back to even a couple hundred years ago, the world is a completely different place. I mean, people are oppressed by poverty or by a feudal system, or you had to bow to kings and all that until someone has the strength to stand up and say no. And so that's where Ethan's character really sets him apart. I guess the real gist to Ethan's character is he wants to kneel to no man and have no man kneel to him. He sees everybody. Everybody should stand on their own and be free, which is in total opposition to everything, the values of that world. I'm in the process of writing the sequel, as well as I have another series I'm doing right now, which is being published by Page Publishing.
All right, Benjamin, thank you. Michael Matre is a retired commercial credit manager who's been writing for 20 years. Why I Never Had Kids was his first book with Page, and now we have a collection of short stories and poems. It's entitled A Spider in the Tub.
It's a collection of short stories, poems, essays, and one commercial script. And actually, I had just written these things and put them in a box in my den trying to find a way to publish them. And I'd gone the route of, you know, the contests and magazines, and I wasn't really getting too far with that. So when I found Page Publishing, I gave it to them, and they took it, and it wound up in the bookstores now. So.
There's so many things. There's so many different things in this book. What stands out for you?
I think I like the short stories, but I also feel like the poems, too, and I think also the essay is because, like a spider, it kind of scurries around. It takes you in different directions. You don't know where you're going when you start, and when you get to the end, you can't really predict, you know.
Okay, so share one of the stories I'm going to find in your book.
The first one there is called To Steal a Tombstone. It's about two boys who want to belong to a club called the Scary Deeters. And initiation-wise, they have to go and steal a tombstone from this local cemetery. It's a cemetery where a lot of old Civil War soldiers are buried. And so after they steal the tombstone, a lot of bad things happen. In the end, eventually, the club manager winds up dead because he played with a Ouija board, I guess, trying to do more things with the occult, and he winds up dead in the end. But the two boys, come out okay. They're not injured, but the ending is gruesome because the club president winds up dead by with the Ouija board experience. One of the stories I think that I like pretty well is called Cruel and Unusual Punishment. It's it's about a man convicted by a judge who thought he should not have been, who comes back and eventually murders the judge in a very, very gruesome way. He was convicted of statutory rape, but he argues that he shouldn't have been because the girl he was with in the bar at 1 a.m. was underage and shouldn't have been there in the first place. But the judge sent him to jail for 5 years. So he comes back and he finally finds where the judge lives, and he takes him captive, and he puts him in a car on a river track, and he lets the train finish him off. It's a gruesome story, yeah.
Where do these stories come from? Do you just make them up in your head, or are they based on experiences you had?
Now, the tombstone story was inspired by an old pioneer graveyard near my childhood home. We used to go there, and we'd walk around, and we'd look at all the old dates on the tombstones. And that's where I got the inspiration for that story.
This sounds like a book perfect for Halloween.
I think it's more a book that's better for a wintry night by a fireplace.
And they're all scary? Is everything scary?
All the short stories, yeah, have kind of a scary element to them, right? I was kind of a Stephen King fan. I like the occult, and I like scary movies on TV, and I watch the Travel Channel off of all the paranormal things they do on there. So I have an interest in that.
Why don't you write something about a virus that infects the world? What do you think? That'd be scary, huh?
Yeah, I think Stephen King did one like that one time. Yeah,
he did. The Stand.
Yeah, that's right. That's it. That's it.
The Stand scared the bejesus out of me, and as soon as this thing started happening, when I was in the very beginning of the coronavirus, I was like, man, this thing, it reminds me of The Stand, you know, people driving through the, you know, Lincoln Tunnel, bumper to bumper traffic, all of a sudden everybody gets sick and dies in their cars, right?
Yeah, it's become fiction, it's become fact, actually. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, a few people aren't affected by the virus, and they describes them walking out of the Lincoln Tunnel over dead bodies. It was just great.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I enjoy. I always enjoy his books, and I've always kind of gone in that direction.
All right, Michael, keep going. You keep going there. Finally, retired from Tampa General Hospital, Marva Williams started writing in 2007 on the advice of a professor who was helping her with a project. And her book, Paul, was inspired by something disturbing she kept seeing over and over again in her travels.
Because of the many trips that I took throughout the United States, I visited a lot of states in my younger years, and I saw a lot of young transients lying in the street with such a woebegone look on their faces and so disheveled, and acting as if they didn't have no way to turn or no way out. And I wanted to write something to inspire them, to make them know that they could do it if they really tried to get out of the situation that they're in. It concerned two transients, interracial transients living on the street, and how they succumb to violence and adversity. And eventually they pulled themselves out of the grime and persevered. They were not accepted by their parents, so they left home in order to be together. In fact, their parents didn't want them to be together, so they left home in order to be together and ended up on the streets. But evidently, it didn't turn out the way they expected it to turn out. But eventually, they persevered and were able to pull themselves up and start a new life.
There are so many homeless people on the streets. For instance, in New York City, it's overwhelming. And I have on occasion interviewed people who will tell me that there are more social services in New York City than anywhere else. It's just, I feel that so many of them have mental illnesses and they just can't.
Right. But, you know, if at anything, they might not help them to pull themselves out of the rut that they're in, but it might give them a food for thought, you know, and say it. And even if they took a little 1 inch of doing better, you know, or 1 inch of just going in the home, just sitting there and observing, something like that. You know, it might not be much, but just a one step at a time, baby steps. One step at a time, and then maybe they will, you know, see themselves and could get help for themselves.
So how are you sharing your book?
You know, I had been sharing it with a few book signings, and I passed out flyers and through the word of mouth mostly. That's about the extent of it, through word of mouth. You know, I had joined a few book critique groups. And what I found out is that I was almost like hitting my head against a stone wall because of we had males and females. And I don't know whether you've been in a whole room of males and females, how dominant they are. And you really didn't know whether you were making the right choice in what you said in your book or whether it was just, you said this about my book, so I'm going to say that about your book. So I, you know, kind of backed off from that a little bit and decided to maybe outdo it on my own. And I am looking for another critique group.
All right, Marva, that's the spirit. And we're out of time. This is the Page Publishing Book Club. Download the podcast at 710WOR.com. I'll catch you next time. I'm Alice Stockton-Rossini.